This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, how medicine is going to the dogs, but in a good way, as we explore the healing value of pet therapy. Plus, how to get help for that aching neck or shoulder. But first, is Upstate University Hospital ready to handle a disaster that could come our way? Hospitals play a key role in disaster readiness throughout our country. And since the terrorist attacks of September 11th and the anthrax scare, hospitals have stepped up their readiness efforts in order to be better prepared in responding to not only traditional disaster threats like extreme weather, but also for terrorist attacks, including the use of chemical, biological, or nuclear agents. We'll hear with more on this is Christopher Dunham. He's the director of the Emergency Management Program for Upstate University Hospital. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Chris, emergency management is on everybody's minds these days, especially, I guess, in the hospitals in this country. Tell us why this is. What is the role of the hospital in this whole picture?
The hospital offers kind of a pillar of response. We're the one thing that really doesn't move easily and that people can go to get better for obvious reasons. It creates some challenges with emergency preparedness. Most businesses can close or relocate or things like that. Typically, a hospital can't do either easily. And we are basically the receiving point for disasters in the community. So if something happens outside of us, and going beyond the multi-vehicle crash or train derailment, they come to us. And that's sort of the end point of the disaster. So we have to be ready for anything.
So how is Upstate University Hospital getting ready or ready, I guess is the question.
We're ready. We prepare actually, strangely, 365 days a year. We do at least two or three full-scale exercises per year. We integrate and meet with the county and discuss disaster plans. We also have a committee that reviews our own plans, tests them. Subject matter experts, people from all disciplines within the hospital structure. And we basically test things as we do. It's a great job in the fact of nothing's ever done, and you can always get better. What's interesting, too, is we apply what's called an incident command response or programming objective to all disasters. In other words...
Yeah, explain what that is.
Incident command is a process of how we would respond to a large-scale incident. It's basically a way to organize a large organization to respond.
So quickly, that, I would think, with speed and accuracy.
Accuracy and also to dedicate the most resources to where it needs it the most. Realistically, Upstate's a very large institution. For a large institution to be responsive during crisis situations, it needs to assume a direct line of communications, command, and things like that, and dedicate resources to where it needs it the most. So if we need stretchers out front to take care of patients, we can do that a little faster.
So you have to set up, besides the practice, I want to get to the drills and the practicing that you do, but it sounds to me like this whole chain of command, or command and control, as they often refer to in the military, is a crucial piece of this, so that something will take over, some body or person or persons will take over in light of some kind of an emergency, and basically take control.
Yeah. On both the administrative and the clinical side, we have higher up leadership who assume command during crisis incidents. We basically communicate that to the rest of the hospital. It changes some of the rules in terms of how we do our day-to-day, but not much. And we dedicate either people, stuff, or area to the whatever crisis is unfolding.
So what kinds, I guess, I want to know so many things. I have so many questions. First of all, what kinds of incidents are you preparing for? In my introduction, I talked about, obviously, this whole notion of the terrorism stuff.
Right.
And sometimes people think in our area of the country that's less likely to occur as opposed to bigger cities where they might be more, popular targets or
Well, I mean, on a statistical average, terrorism is a little less likely than, let's say, a big train derailment or a multi-vehicle accident, things like that. I mean,
or an ice storm.
Exactly, exactly. And that can be just as crippling, or if not more so, to some extent. We prepare for almost everything. We assess on a yearly basis what we consider, and this is the Emergency Preparedness Committee, what we consider to be the top five priorities of things we need to worry about are threats. Number one on the list is always what we term as influx of patients, which could be almost any reason, whether it be the vehicle crash, pandemic, epidemic, which is something we test and drill for extensively.
Things, for example, at one point a few years back, they were talking about avian flu mm-hmm. or something, swine flu or things yep. of that nature, where yep. you could be flooded
yes.
with patients.
Yeah. The hospital is always a very busy place. We're always
anyway.
Very, yeah. yeah it, to begin on any given day, you add another percentage of the population that either believes it's sick or could be truly sick with some highly contagious virus, you cripple the system. And part of incident command is keeping the system going. In other words, we don't want to stop the care we already give unless we absolutely have to or something out of the ordinary happens. So we prepare for pandemics. We prepare for the terrorism. We do that too. We prepare for, let's say, an anthrax attack. We have a decontamination team that can set up a response capabilities and basically decontaminate a patient before they enter the building so they don't contaminate the hospital.
In this world, I mean, with so much going on, you think about what's happening in the Middle East and mm-hmm. all of the kind of constant change and the fact that terrorism can be exported with one person flying with an American passport from the Middle East somewhere and wreaking havoc, it could things could happen in a place like Central New York as well. So clearly you really do need to be prepared for anything.
Yeah, anything. I mean, and that's, we take a global approach or an all hazards approach to incident command. And that's the nice thing about the incident command system is that it allows us to apply almost the same matrix to almost any threat. So the response, you can train people on the response, and that's pretty much the same. Now the choices they have in front of them will always evolve and be different, but how they set up the process to help them remains the same.
And resources are obviously crucial, having the resources yep. in place to be yep. able to respond.
Yep. And we take a look at our threats on a yearly basis, and we identify the resources we would have on hand. Let's say if we lost water in certain parts of the hospital, we would have water, bottled water available to give out and distribute. And those are some of the resources we already pre-deploy in the event of, you know, that happening.
So you just said earlier, I said, how ready is Upstate University Hospital? And you say, we are ready.
We are, yeah.
What kinds of drills are you doing on a regular basis? You mentioned you have three major incident yep. drills.
We have more than that. We actually do a couple different types of drills. We do what's called a full-scale exercise, and we do those probably at least twice a year, if not more. And those typically involve not just our hospital, which is both the community campus and the downtown campus, but we also involve our community partners. EMS, so the Emergency Medical Service, the fire department. Also, Onondaga County plays an important role in this. Also, integrating with the local Department of Health. They have a emergency management department and getting them involved in those drills and making sure everybody's in the same loop. And usually we try to expand those drills to stress the system. It's fine that we do a drill that is very small if we learn something very specific, but usually we try to stress the system because that's when we learn the most. We could do the same drill year in and year out and never really learn anything, and we're not doing anybody any favors. We also do what are called tabletop drills, which are basically facilitated discussions, where I'll get some leadership in a room and I'll throw a problem on the board saying, okay, this just happened. And that's less in terms of clinical, but that's more in terms of a response, like how do we set up command?
What are the infrastructure?
What is the infrastructure? What are the resources you have on hand to do that?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Christopher Dunham. He's the Director of Emergency Management for Upstate University Hospital, and we're talking about disaster preparedness. So give me one example of a kind of drill. Well, the large-scale drills. I mean, do you blow up an airplane? I mean, what do you do to practice?
We haven't blown up anything in a very long time, thank goodness. We do decontamination drills, so we simulate a contaminated patient arriving in our ED. And we have a team that's dedicated and trained very extensively to respond to such a thing within the hospital. So the patient arrives in our facility. They would set up a decontamination tent and roll out some protective equipment. So these people have to put on what's referred to as a powered air respirator, so it's a PAPR. And there's some training that goes along with that. And basically they decontaminate or shower the patient and make sure they treat any life threats at the time and then bring them in and treat them like a regular patient. But the process to do that, it's a multi-step process. It takes quite a while. It's very extensive. And we do that probably three or four times a year.
Wow. Well, let me get, you mentioned something about water before, and that what you would do if we, if the hospital didn't have water or power or all of those kinds of things. Let's help our listeners at home. I know that people have talked a lot about what to do in an emergency. Can you give us a feeling for what people should do to prepare at home for an emergency? In other words, what's the first step? Should they gather a particular kit together of items?
Certainly there's a lot of aftermarket kits they can buy for preparedness. I mean, if you type that into any search engine on the internet, you'll get a lot of things for sale. Some of the simple things are usually the best. With the understanding that you need to be able to do a couple things very well. You need to be able to communicate. You need to be able to basically relocate if necessary. And you also need to be able to protect what you have. Keep a copy of all important papers, but keep it somewhere where you can grab it and leave. Also keep a way to communicate, maybe extra batteries for the cell phone, or maybe a radio where you can listen to news, a whistle. During Hurricane Katrina, that became actually an important item for people to have.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, communicate is communicate. It doesn't have to be across the county. It can even be down the road. So a whistle would be sometimes important. Flashlights, batteries, things like that. Food, water is critical. Typically, water is usually what takes the longest to get to find.
Clean water, especially if there's an issue. So how many days water supply should someone have, for example?
If you go to ready.gov, which is the sort of FEMA website that allows people to look at a more complete list, typically anywhere from 48 to 96 hours worth of water. So that's pretty much a couple gallons per person per day. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that people tend to forget, and if you look at all the literature, is extra medicine, especially for special populations or special needs populations in terms of the elderly or very young. You want to bring diapers for the kids or baby formula or what have you, something to get them through.
So the other thing, when you talk about communication, not only in terms of yourselves and the outside world, but how about within your family, for example?
Right.
Should you be talking within your family about what to do if should something strike? I mean, we hear all the time now in the Midwest about tornadoes coming and devastating communities.
Right. Have a plan and communicate it. Basically, if you have to relocate, I mean, you can't have a plan for everything. But have a plan of saying, okay, look, if we have to move or we have to relocate, we're going to try to go here first or try to make this phone call first. And communicate that so somebody else knows. I hike a lot, so usually I'll tell somebody where I'm hiking.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's ultimately you communicate where you go. So if something does happen, people have a general idea of what you were trying to do, and that aids rescuers immensely.
But clearly what you've said, which I think is interesting, is that all of this information really is readily available for people if they were to go on the internet and look under emergency preparedness or, as you said, the FEMA site.
Yep. Ready.gov.
It's ready.gov.
Yep. It's all right there. And the government's actually done a really good job, especially after Hurricane Katrina and 9/11, of preparing just kits you can print off, and it gives you everything you need.
Well, it gives me a feeling of security knowing that you're here watching over the work here at Upstate University Hospital, because it is the pillar and it will be a pillar in obviously in any emergency that we might face. So I want to thank you for coming in and sharing all the information with us.
Thank you.
And,
thank you for having me.
You feel Upstate is ready.
I do.
Very, very good. Well, my guest has been Christopher Dunham. He's Director of Emergency Management for Upstate University Hospital. Coming up, the healing value of pets. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Is medicine going to the dogs? Yes, it is, but in a wonderful way. Animal-assisted therapy can help healing and lessen depression and fatigue. And here with more on this are Margaret Nellis, she's Child Life Manager at Upstate University Hospital, and Cindy Griffith, she's a pet owner volunteer, and she has brought along her pet therapy dog, Sebastian. He's a 10-year-old toy poodle, and he's the cutest thing I've seen in years. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming in. Sebastian's sitting here with his paw on the table, ready to go. And now you're listening to me, Sebastian, right? Would you say something to the microphone? Probably not on command. No, but it's looking at you, Cindy. So, Margaret, tell us about this program. It's a pet therapy program at Upstate. Tell us about it. What is it, and how did it get started?
I started the research back in 1993 regarding how pets can make a big difference in the healing of children while they're in the hospital. And it took about 5 years to really get it off the ground. There was the State Department Health Codes were very strict about what kind of animal could come in the hospital. And they were really service. It was directed towards service animals and not really having dogs come in and visit in an acute care unit. And the driving force behind the research for me was a little girl that I was taking care of, a hematology oncology patient who missed her dog tremendously and was quite upset and struggling with her diagnosis, as well as being here from Binghamton, so not locally.
And so she was away from home.
Away from home.
And away from her, yes. Her pet, yes. Whom obviously she loved.
Yeah, she had a Irish setter who she missed tremendously, and she begged her mom and dad every day to bring the dog. And they did bring the dog, but the dog had to come to the outside of the hospital. And you could just see her get so upset when they put the dog back in the car to take home. So it really was the driving force for me to do a little bit of research on how animals can make a difference in the lives of children who are struggling with chronic illness and really with any kind of illness.
And did you find that the health department was a partner in this, or did it stand in your way? What kind of challenges did you find?
The codes were pretty strict. And being a state university, it was really spelled out that, you know, it was only service animals that were permitted.
Service animals meaning like if you were blind.
Correct. Or you needed some help in getting around. There's different service animals for different
categories.
Categories. And what I did was I found out if there were any hospitals in New York State that were doing a pilot and having animals come. And I did come upon St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City that was doing a pilot in a pediatric unit. And so, again, I was digging and digging, and I had asked if I could do the pilot. I asked hospital administration within Upstate, and they basically said, I don't know, Margaret, about changing that code. That's going to be a lot of work. And I said, well, I'm willing to put the work in if you will stand behind me. So they said, okay, go have it. So I did, and I was getting the paperwork together. And in the meantime, I asked hospital administration, would they be willing to at least give me permission to have the animals visit on the outside of the hospital and not actually bring the animals in? And they said, okay, you know, follow infection control standards, washing hands, what have you. And yes, you may have the dogs come and visit the children outside. So I started outside for, it took about 5 years. We had the dogs come outside and the children come outside.
Wow.
And in the meantime, I was working on the pilot. And in the meantime, St. Vincent's in New York had finished. Everything had proven. There were no obstacles. And I got
No
health risks. And the Department of Health called me and they said, you don't even have to finish the paperwork. If the hospital administration's behind you, risk management is behind you, infection control, go ahead and put a program together.
Wow.
They changed, they amended the code in New York State, and here
what
we are today.
What an accomplishment for you.
Yes.
And for the children and the hospital at large.
It was amazing. It was a big feat. I have the date in my head. May 1998 was the day I got the letter.
Wow.
And Assemblyman Bragman was behind me. He actually sent a letter to defend my post in believing that pets could help kids.
So tell us about the program now. I mean, this was you started. That was over 10 years ago.
Long time.
Yeah. So now, what's been going on, and how does it work?
Well, the program expanded. We started in pediatrics, and now the program actually is expanded to 2 North, which is our rehabilitation physical medicine.
For adults as well.
For adults and kids, yes. And then it also is on psychiatry, on 4B, the inpatient unit in the hospital. So right now it's peds, psychiatry, and physical medicine and rehab. And we have had requests from other adult units. And we have granted some requests, but we really do not just let the animals and owners go to units that don't have an established staff member that's vested in organizing the program and following through, because we don't want to jeopardize and have any infection control issues, and then the program would be not happening.
So who gets to see the dogs now? I mean, you mentioned some of the situations. How do you determine who would have Sebastian come visit?
What we do, any child on isolation cannot have a visit. Other than that, as long as the doctor gives the order, the child can have the visit. So we do have to have an order from the physician, and we have to have parents' consent.
So it's basically, at this point, help us understand the goals of the program as you see it, and mm-hmm. how it's being, you know, actuated, how people are getting, how many kids or adults, for example, are taking, having the opportunity.
Wow. Well, I know on pediatrics, so I know Cindy, when she comes to visit, you could see how many kids.
Sometimes we're there for like 2.5 hours, and we may see as many as 15 or 20 kids.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. A busy day.
Right. And we have Cindy and another pet owner volunteer, Tom, who comes with his dog, Daphne. And they could do another 20. And we have a third person. She's been on medical leave. So we would say maybe 60 kids a month that we would see on a regular basis.
And the goals from your standpoint?
The goals really, you know, as if you have an animal or a dog at home or a cat, they're unconditional love. They love you for who you are. They're not judging you based on your diagnosis. If you're burned, if you have no hair, or you know, you're not able to talk. They come in, they can sense what you need, and they just kind of go up to the child, and before you know it, they've bonded. So really the goals are to provide some nurturing to both the patient and to the dog. I think it's a two-way street. They both get something from the interaction. And it's sometimes it's goal-driven, and if we don't have a child that's talking or maybe is having some problems with coping with the hospitalization, the presence of the dog just gives them the ability to open up and start talking about their animal at home or an animal they know. So it's kind of a, an unpredictable relationship. But the goal is really...
It's comfort and nurturance.
It's comfort and nurture.
Like, and
yeah,
acceptance.
Comfort and acceptance.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Child Life Manager Margaret Nellis and our pet therapy volunteer Cindy Griffith and her little pet therapy dog Sebastian, who is 10 years old and he is gorgeous. He is a beautiful toy poodle. And we're talking about what we're doing with pet therapy here at University Hospital. Cindy, you have been a volunteer for quite a while. Tell us about your experience.
Yes. Well, I started, it was probably about 8 years ago as a volunteer here. I had just become a member of what is now the PAWS program, was Sunshine Friends at the time, with my dog Sebastian.
And the PAWS program stands for Pet Assisted Wellness Services.
Services, correct.
Okay.
We just changed our name recently, and we were originally Sunshine Friends. And part of the training with Sebastian was that he had to have, in order to go into the hospitals, what they call canine good citizenship certification. And he had just received that through Sunshine Friends. And so I was interested in doing something at the hospitals. And I had heard Upstate had a great program. So I joined the volunteer services. Took about 6 months to get through all the recruitment, and Sebastian also had to go through orientation basically and be approved by the hospital. He had to be seen by the volunteer services, and they had to more or less interview him to see how his temperament was
right.
and whether they felt he would work out in a hospital setting. And so at that point we started coming up here, and one of our first assignments was pediatrics. Obviously, Gail Sano was not here yet at that time, so we were in the main hospital working there. He also was working in, at that time, they had the program in medical ICU, and he worked in medical ICU and also in the rehab program that Margaret mentioned. So he was in all three places originally.
Why did you get involved in this, though?
I got involved in it just because Sebastian really was the catalyst for me. When we got him as a puppy, the reason we picked him was there was just something. I'd had a lot of dogs, but this one in particular had this ability to connect. From the time that I picked him out of the litter, he would do a lot with eye contact and just really was very intuitive. And I saw that in him, and I thought that, you know, he would really be good with, he just loved people, that he seemed to connect with people really well. And I felt that would be a really good fit for the program.
And you obviously had a need to be a help.
Absolutely.
And to help people with their pain and suffering. So
absolutely.
This is such a wonderful way to do it. And obviously, Sebastian is a very calm animal as we sit here talking on the radio, and he's just nestling so sweetly in your arms. So what has it meant for you to do this?
For me, it's been a tremendous privilege. I really look at it as a privilege and an opportunity to just be a part of people's lives, that people that I would never ordinarily have gotten to meet. I've met some wonderful patients and their families. I've been able to, I hope, at least bring a little bit of peace and brightness in the days of, you know, their suffering and their health issues, and just maybe give some respite to them. And to be able to use Sebastian to do that has just been just so fulfilling. I always say people always are thanking us for doing this, and I always say that I get so much more out of it than I put into it. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, I can see it on your face. Mm-hmm. How about Sebastian? Do you think he gets something out of it?
I do. As a matter of fact, I will tell you that when we come to the hospital, he knows when his certification vest goes on that he's, I always say, going to work. That's his job, and that's what he's been trained to do. And when I put him in the car to come up here, as soon as we turn onto Adams Street, as a rule, he starts barking incessantly as soon as he sees the hospital. And he just gets so excited to be doing this. And so I think for him, too, it's a purpose. And I think, you know, animals need a purpose, too. They need a reason to be. And I think this is his purpose. I think this is why he was put here. And I hope he's brought some joy and happiness
it
to
sounds
people
like he,
here.
Excuse me. It sounds like he must have. Do you have any stories to tell us? Can you think of any particular event that was particularly poignant for you?
I do. There was one little boy, and this was not too long after we had started working up here at the hospital. It was prior to Galisano's, and he was in the pediatric unit. He had brain surgery the day before, and they were having a struggle with him because they were trying to change his IV, and he was being very uncooperative and had been crying and pretty much giving them a difficult time. They didn't know what they were going to do, and then they realized that this was the day Sebastian was at the hospital, so they decided to try and use his therapy. So we came into the room. The boy was crying. He was probably about 9 or 10 years old, and I put Sebastian up on the bed like I normally would do, and I started talking to him, and I asked him, you know, if he played sports, if he liked baseball, just to kind of get his mind unfocused from what was going on, what he was upset about. And as we talked, I noticed that all of a sudden he started to put his hand down and he started petting Sebastian. Mm-hmm. And after a minute or two of that, he suddenly stopped and he grabbed his head and he said, "Oh my gosh." And we all, the nurses and the staff and I myself, you know, were kind of like, "Oh no, what's the matter?" Figuring there was something physically wrong. And he looked at me and he said, "Don't anybody laugh at me." And I said, "No one's going to laugh at you. What's the matter?" And he said, "It's my brain." He said, "I feel it's healing."
Oh, wow.
And it was such a moment. The staff everyone, we just kind of took a deep breath. I said to him, "You know, this is what the research shows, the mind-body, that if you feel better in your head, the chemicals, the chemistry, you'll heal better. And you've just proven to us and told us that it works."
Wow, wow. Well, I can see why every day you come here must be an incredible experience, and you really are spreading so much healing and goodness. I want to thank you both so much for coming in. My guests have been Margaret Nellis. She's Child Life Manager at Upstate University Hospital, and she developed this whole pet therapy program, and pet owner volunteer Cindy Griffith and her beautiful little dog, Sebastian, 10-year-old toy poodle. Thanks again for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink. And now, in our expert advice from the experts at Upstate segment, we have Dr. Ruth Weinstock, the medical director of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Upstate, and she's going to walk us through what advice she gives to a person who is newly diagnosed with diabetes.
The good news is that we have better ways of treating diabetes today than we ever have had in the past and of preventing the complications. The most important thing is to learn the most you can about diabetes. So at our diabetes center, we spend a huge amount of time with patient education. We have nurse educators, dietitians, a whole team that really help people both in classes and also one-on-one to understand all the self-management skills they need, as well as lifestyle issues, so that they can best take care of themselves, stay healthy, and prevent diabetes. For someone with type 2 diabetes who is overweight, that dietary management and possibly going on an oral agent may be the initial steps, but they still need to know how to monitor their blood sugar, how to prevent foot problems, good foot care, what to do when they feel sick. Wide variety of issues need to be covered. With type 1 diabetes, the issues are more complex at the time of diagnosis because they need to start insulin therapy. So then there's a lot of education about how best to administer insulin, a lot of dietary issues related to insulin use and how to prevent low blood sugars. But we do try to emphasize that we have many tools available now, that we're here to support them, we're here to answer questions, and the more they understand how to manage their disease and all the assistance that we can give them and technology can give them, that they should be able to live a nice, healthy life.
Up next, how to get help for that aching neck and shoulder. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. Here's our Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Be safe in the sun. While everyone loves to be a little tan in the summer months, it's important to protect your skin from the damaging effects of the sunshine. Sunscreen with at least a 30 SPF is essential in protecting you from UVA and UVB rays. Well, you may have heard the terms UVA and UVB before, but maybe you don't quite know what the difference is. Well, both UVA and UVB rays are responsible for cancer. But the UVB rays are what gives you the sunburn, and the UVA rays is what ages your skin. Look for a sunscreen that says broadband protection. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. In recent years, there has been what has been called an epidemic of neck and shoulder pain in this country. There are probably many factors contributing to this, the widespread use of computers in many industries, including healthcare for starters. But with more on this common problem and what can be done about it is Dr. William Lavelle. He's assistant professor of adult and pediatric spine and scoliosis surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Lavelle.
Thank you for having me.
So neck and shoulder pain are very prevalent. Why is that? What are you seeing?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with your earlier comments. Patients now do more and more. People do more and more with activities such as working with computers, working with objects seated at a desk, and that requires us to have our heads down, which would put us at risk for neck arthritis and disc herniations. And in addition, with our active lifestyles, with both work and recreation, working our shoulder is something that could put us at risk for injury. And that's why we see more and more today problems with neck and shoulder pain. And it really is a hard thing to figure which of these is causing you the pain. be it your neck or be it your shoulder.
Actually, I read somewhere that they started to call it schneck pain, which I got a real kick out of, because they said you have neck and shoulder pain commonly overlapping, and sometimes it's really hard, as you said, to determine which it is. So I guess some brilliant orthopedist decided to call it schneck pain.
Right. We always stick funny names to things, but it really is more common today to have both neck and shoulder problems. And it really does pay to spend some time to figure out which is the primary cause of your pain to try to make you better.
I want to get to that one second, but tell me, generally, who do you think is most at risk for these? We mentioned the idea of working at a desk, but this must go across the age range. So who and why do you see, who gets it and why do you think in general?
Unfortunately, everybody gets it. It goes across the spectrum. The thing that really changes is not whether they have pain, it's why they have pain. So we tend to find younger, more athletic patients tend to have sprains and strains, things like soft disc herniations in their neck, things like tendon tears in their shoulder, while older patients tend to have more arthritic changes in both their necks and their shoulders. Fortunately for most of us, care is oftentimes non-operative, but requires care that is tailored to what's wrong with you.
So that's exactly what I want to get to now. So then, as you alluded to, we need to try to determine the source of the pain. And since sometimes it overlaps, I guess, because the neck and shoulder are intimately connected by their pathways, nerve pathways, does that play a role too?
I think that's very true. Not only are they connected by their nerve pathways, but by their physical location. Your shoulder girdle, all of the muscles that attach to your shoulder, also have some insertions in your neck, which is why there's oftentimes overlap in terms of musculoskeletal pain. Additionally, the nerves that run down into your arms originate at your neck, and at times if you have a pinched nerve in your neck, it could cause you significant pain that goes down into your shoulder and into your arm.
So how do you tell the difference? How do you know, for example, that the shoulder is the usual suspect, so to speak?
Well, oftentimes you're told by the history. Repetitive use of your shoulder, that provokes the pain. In other words, every time that you try to use your shoulder to swing and hit a tennis ball, every time you use your shoulder, particularly for overhead activities, would make you think that the shoulder is the primary cause of your pain. That's opposite to what you would see with neck symptoms. Interestingly, with regards to neck symptoms, if it's nerve pain, it's oftentimes associated with numbness and tingling that goes not only down into your shoulder, but can also go down in through your arm and into your hand. So the numbness and tingling are really signs that would point to your neck.
So that would be kind of almost the discriminatory factor there between the two.
That it would.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with spinal surgeon Dr. William Lavelle. We're talking about neck and shoulder pain, and we'll get to the cause. We've talked a little bit about the causes, and we'll get to more and treatment options. So let's get to causes. We've alluded to some things: overuse, age-related things, whether they be arthritis or underlying conditions. But what specifically would be the cause shoulders to create pain?
So in terms of the shoulder, the way the shoulder is anatomically put together, you have a series of tendons that run underneath a bony component, which is called the acromion. As we get older, we get arthritic changes in the shoulder that can cause irritation to those tendons and cause a shoulder pain. When we're younger, most of the injuries that happen to your shoulder are traumatic in terms of collision activities, hyperextension injuries.
So fractures, collarbone injuries, that type of thing?
Very true. But as we get older, the arthritic changes can cause chronic wear and tear to those tendons and cause conditions such as bursitis and, at its end stage, true shoulder arthritis.
How about things like a rotator cuff? Is that secondary more to overuse or age-related, or can it happen through trauma?
It can happen with both. Rotator cuff tears can happen from end-stage arthritic changes to the shoulder, where the tendons have been abraded by bony osteophytes to the point where they're torn completely. As you pointed out, traumatic injuries such as falls, particularly a fall that causes a shoulder dislocation in somebody over the age of 40, can cause a rotator cuff tear that needs to be potentially repaired. One of the worst, most worrisome signs with both neck and shoulder pathology is true weakness. So if you're a patient who has truly weakness of your arm or your shoulder, you should seek medical attention right away.
How about, what is this term frozen shoulder? I've heard that so many times. What exactly does that mean?
Frozen shoulder is a medical condition whereupon your shoulder does just that, that you have inflammatory changes in the shoulder where the shoulder has a difficult time moving. And in essence, it really is like the shoulder joint itself is frozen. Fortunately, the best treatment for it is typically conservative care with physical therapy. And one of the terms, as is the term frozen shoulder, is what's called shoulder thawing, where the okay. shoulder, through time and careful physical therapy, is able to regain its range of motion.
It's also can be a consequence of having a fracture perhaps lower down in the arm, not being able to use the arm or having the arm to be... I know I'm talking from yes. personal experience of having broken a right. part of my arm and developing what was called a frozen shoulder.
And that is true. Additional trauma can be a cause of it. Sometimes it can happen for just any other reason. Even something as a minor trauma can lead to a frozen shoulder, which is heralded, again, as you pointed out, by stiffness.
How about the neck idea? I mean, so what are the kinds of things that contribute to or cause neck pain?
Well, unfortunately, the degenerative process happens to all of us. And the first component of the degenerative process is actually disc problems. Both in the low back and in the neck, we see that the first stage is disc degeneration. So when patients ask me, "Doctor, do I have disc degeneration or do I have arthritis?" the answer actually is both. The discs allow us to move in our neck, and they are the first site of degenerative changes. So even patients who are not older but are not victims of acute trauma can have disc changes that can cause them first neck pain and later pinched nerves in their neck if the disc material, in fact, herniates and compresses those nerves.
So the fact is that's an inevitable part of aging. And I don't even mean older age, but just as we age, those things happen.
It is an inevitable part of aging. There's actually been MRI studies that show that greater than 30% of people have degenerative changes as they go over the age of 40 years old.
But not all people have neck pain. So what may push you over the edge then, assuming that all of us have some degree of degenerative changes going on?
And that's a really hard question to answer because we do find radiographically people with degenerative changes on their images that are entirely asymptomatic, which is why one of the things we teach at a medical school like Upstate is that we treat patients, we don't treat their images. It's hard to figure out who is going to eventually become symptomatic. Unfortunately, in our busy society, lots of people do, and that's why we have to take time and care for them to make them better.
Some of the other things that contribute to neck pain might be things like a tumor, for example, or a degenerative disease of some kind, other than...
Fortunately, most of the time, tumors are a very rare condition. However, particular findings such as nighttime pain that is unremitting, associated weight loss, and unfortunately weakness are findings that should prompt you to seek prompt medical attention, as they could be signs of more ominous things like tumors and infections.
How about things like posture?
Posture has been found to have a significant relationship to pain. We find more and more today people with neck pain, and as you pointed out, some of the things that we do, such as working at a desk, looking down, are things that can provoke neck pain because we tend to find that we load those discs in our neck more with bringing our head down into a flexed position. Additionally, the only way that the neck works is to fire muscles in the back of your neck to allow you to change your neck's posture. So the more we demand out of our neck, the more likely it is that it will be painful for us.
And the truth is, just to live in our society these days, we're all going to be prone to this kind of thing, it sounds like. So let's get to treatments a little bit, because I think that's always a big question. I know I won't even go to the back, because the back is a major, you know, big question mark. But let's stick with shoulder and neck. What do you suggest for soft tissue, you know, causes for neck and shoulder pain? What kind of treatments?
I think the first thing that would have to be addressed is how long the pain's been going on. For an acute episode of pain that has only lasted a few days, the first and foremost thing to do is to stop the activity that's promoted the pain, to rest, to consider the use of anti-inflammatory medicines and see if those symptoms resolve in the course of a week or two.
Do you generally recommend things like the Advil, Motrin, or Naproxen type stuff, or do you also recommend Tylenol, acetaminophen type drugs?
So the answer to that is yes and yes. We find that both of those medications can be helpful. We find that while Tylenol is a relatively safe drug, it doesn't work in terms of really treating the problem, which oftentimes is inflammation. Oftentimes, personally as a physician, I recommend anti-inflammatory medicines. Again, noting that there are side effects to anti-inflammatory medicines.
How about things like corticosteroid injections? How frequently do you recommend those?
So typically after a patient has failed other conservative means, do we go to things like corticosteroid injections? They have their place. Steroid injections truly do have their place, but they should be after a trial of oral anti-inflammatory medicines as well as exercise-based modalities like physical therapy. And the reason being is that when you're doing something like a steroid injection, you're actually introducing a medicine into somebody's body through the skin. So there is a little bit more of a risk in terms of things like infection and bleeding. That being said, if a situation calls for it and a patient's that symptomatic, it is a very reasonable thing to do.
Do you think heat and ice help?
Heat and ice do help, particularly for the acute phase of an injury. Ice is one of the first things that we recommend for a sprain or a strain in the acute phase as it settles down inflammation. Ice is a great anti-inflammatory topical agent. Heat actually helps with blood flow, and the thought is that after 48 hours, heat helps blood to get into an area that has to heal. So
in the little bit of time we have left, what's your bottom line recommendation? When should somebody seek professional care?
First and foremost, patients should seek professional care if, in fact, they have weakness of their arm, weakness of their shoulder. That should always bring a patient to the doctor. Failure of what would be reasonable conservative care on your own. If your neck hurts and you try to give it some rest and you take some anti-inflammatory medicines, if that lasts longer than 2 weeks, then seeing someone is probably the next step.
Well, I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. William Lavelle. He's assistant professor of adult and pediatric spine and scoliosis surgery at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks a lot for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Our founding editor, Bonnie St. Andrews, she's very well known for many, many medical poems, but she also had some very happy poems about vacations, summertime. This seems an appropriate season for us to read her poem, Opening the Summer House, by B.A. St. Andrews. Sun-drenched and one with the universe, I am sweeping this kitchen, singing at the top and bottom of essentially tuneless lungs. On the porch, I contemplate a cormorant, precariously balanced atop sails, wings outstretched, frail as a purple Jesus steadying for nails. Being neither bird nor sacred boy, I tremble in joy, if not redemption, and scrub down doomsday thoughts and dogmas of denial. For a precious fortnight, sin itself is not on trial. In beguiling heat, I perceive myself a deity, and so decree. Humans need atone for nothing. Cardinal-hatted hollyhocks agree. My life plies with waves that leap like ballerinas on the jetty, spinning diaphanous skirts of foam. Gull, cod, cloud, plover, everything dances or hovers. Crescendo, decrescendo, Triton blasts sea symphonies against stone. Sunbeams clap topaz hands while girls plant shells like dreams in amber sand. I am planting too. Come high tide and harvest moon, love itself may slide inside my cave of dreams, mystic and wild as a silky. Alive with light, I am pounded thin as a compact disc by sound. I am a silver filament humming in August heat, a one-woman network of good news. All my links and lines are open. When I take the airwaves, Mother Nature has her say. Pipers promise yes, south winds murmur stay.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine that sometimes silent but potentially dangerous condition known as atrial fibrillation, and how a new medical device may save lives. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.